Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Well, thank you so much. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Close Up Talk Radio. An amazing half hour is ahead of us today. We are going to explore a really unique aspect, a highly specialized aspect of the field of medical care. We're going to be talking to a highly experienced, board-certified diagnostic radiologist. And for those of you who aren't that familiar with this field, I'm sure there are terms you've heard that you may know or say, hey, I've heard of that before, but you may not know really how complex it is, what it does, and what it accomplishes, and its role in the field of medical care. So let me explain a little bit to you, and then we'll get to our guest. Allow me to point out that during our lifetime, most of us will be referred by your primary care doctor to undergo some medical imaging exams. And that would include a simple thing like an X-ray. I'm sure you know what that is. Many of you may not know, however, what a mammogram, an MRI is, computerized tomography, magnetic resonance imaging, that's an MRI, and ultrasounds. Now, these are all types of imaging tests that provide an in-depth analysis of your skeletal structure to determine the gravity of an injury or a disease. A very common misconception people have is that a radiologist is the one who administers the test. That's not true. It is, in fact, performed by a radiologist technician. And most of us aren't aware that a radiologist is a highly trained, skilled doctor who is responsible for performing an analysis of the diagrams and determining of what the best course of action in order for you to heal successfully would be. In other words, he studies the results of the MRI or the X-ray. He has to be highly educated and really very, very smart in order to come up with the results of those tests. Our guest is Dr. Joseph Burke. He is, as I said before, a board-certified diagnostic radiologist. He has over 24 years of experience practicing, specializing in neurologic imaging, vascular imaging, trauma and emergency radiology, body and neurologic CAT scans, pulmonary imaging, gastrointestinal imaging, and genitourinary imaging, focusing on radiographs, ultrasounds, CAT scans, and MRI. That's a mouthful, but it's very imaging, interesting, and it's early here for me. Anyway, his work as a doctor plays a truly crucial role in people's health care. He interprets the medical imaging from all those sources, and then he helps determine what's going on inside the patient's body, and he provides a detailed evaluation that the radiologist then gives to the clinical providers, that key information to aid in the diagnosis and the treatment of a patient's condition and diseases. It's an amazing field. And as an authority in the field of radiology, Dr. Burke, by the way, has examined thousands of images in his career. He works in one of the busiest emergency departments on the East Coast of the U.S. in a Level 1 trauma center, as well as one of the largest and most reputable cancer centers in the country. It's a real pleasure to have Dr. Joseph Burke join us to help educate us a little bit on all of these practices and technologies that I've been talking about, even if they're hard to pronounce at this hour of the morning. Dr. Burke, it's nice to have you with us. How are you? Welcome.
Good morning, Doug. How are you?
Listen, I'm fascinated by a number of things of your story, and I'm just wondering, let me step back quickly and ask you, when you went to school, I mean, you were highly educated, you had the degree, you could have become a medical doctor, I know. You picked this field of diagnostic radiology. What was it that caused you to be so interested in the field in the very beginning? How would you answer that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Doug. Way back when I was in medical school, radiology was sort of a different field. Nowadays, radiologic imaging can all be digitized. Back in the old day, if you remember, X-rays and CAT scans were produced and recorded and stored on film. And so a person's film jacket, all your imaging studies were all located centrally in the radiology department in a hospital. So if you want to see a patient's X-rays, your patient's X-rays, you would go down to the radiology department and pull their file and pull out the films and hang them on a view box. So consequently, when you were part of a surgical team or the OB team or you're doing a pediatric rotation in medical school and you need to see all the different X-rays or CAT scans on the particular patients of the OB staff or whatever, you would go as a group to the radiology rounds, and a radiologist would walk you through the five or six different imaging studies that your patients may all have in the hospital. So it was a centrally located area in the hospital, and you had to go to radiology rounds every single day. So as a medical student or, you know, as a fourth-year medical student, I would be joining the team and going to radiology rounds. And, you know, as radiologists would be explaining different things to the team, for some weird reason, I just completely understood exactly what they were talking about. The anatomy that is projected two-dimensionally on an X-ray film or a CAT scan film would be three-dimensional in my head. I don't know how to explain it. And so when they would explain this or explain that, some of the other interns may be shaking their head like, I don't really get it. But I kind of really understood it from almost instantaneously, and it really had it struck a nerve with me to say, at least I should do – in medical school, your fourth year, you can do elective rotations. You certainly have your base rotations you must perform to graduate. But much like in college, you can take some elective classes or elective rotations, and I chose to do that. I actually chose to take two separate months of radiology in different hospitals. And after those 2 months of spending, you know, 8 weeks or so in different hospitals, always in the radiology department, learning more from their medical, their educational staff, I knew that was my career path.
Really? You fell in love with it to begin with. Explain a little bit about what additional training you have to be able to diagnose the results of these various technologies. Because I would assume today, rather than looking at an X-ray that you're holding in your hand and getting out of a file, you do all this by looking at computer screens. And would that be right?
That is correct. Almost all of it, yes. But for me, the training for any physician is a residency after they graduate medical school. For a lot of professions like pediatrics and family practice and internal medicine, it tends to be about 3 years of additional training just in that field. Surgery, whether it be neurosurgery or general surgery, orthopedic, tends a little longer. But for radiology, it's typically 5 additional years after 4 years of medical school. You typically do a year of generalized medicine internship, then 4 years of radiology residency.
Wow. That's 9 years, right?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Ooh.
Yes.
Did you ever,
9 years
did
after
you ever
college.
Think, when am I going to get out of school? How old were you when you got out of school?
I was the typical age. I was 31. That's the often
31.
Age. You can imagine, neurosurgery is even longer. Most neurosurgical programs, radiology is 5. I think neurosurgery could be 7 or 8 years. So most of those young men and women are 34 to 35 by the time they're done their training.
Wow. Well, it's a lot of credit to you that you stuck with it, you know, and you know, you found something that you liked, and you're able to do it and do it well. So which is really so great. So let's explain a little bit about what you actually do. I know you're sitting in, you know, the MRI. People who've had an MRI don't really know what the end result is. What, you know, it's an MRI. Explain what it is and what kind of actual result is the result of the MRI. It's still an image on a,
sure.
on a screen you're looking at, right?
Correct. It tends to be many, many images. An MRI is a fantastic imaging tool. It's like you said before, magnetic resonance imaging. Unlike CT scans or X-rays, there's no radiation utilized. It actually utilizes,
right.
and I won't get into the physics of it, since humans are about 88%, 89% water, the water molecule has a minimal microscopic ionic charge. And an MRI uses a very high-strength magnet to make those molecules of water spin. And when they spin, they generate a microscopic radio signal of different frequencies. And depending on the frequency, we can get different imaging of how fast those waters spin in muscle or spin in blood or spin in
fluid or spin in bone, or and you can generate quite high contrast detailed images of the human anatomy and pathology using an MRI. And there are a million different reasons for MRI, you know, for the musculoskeletal world, for ACL tears and meniscal tears, and musculoskeletal imaging is wonderful. For neuroimaging of the brain and the spine, and the brachial plexus and the nerves, it's just quite spectacular. But really, we've come a long way. You know, we as things have evolved, I'm now one of the few select readers in our radiology group who reads just, you know, we do MRIs just of the prostate gland, you know, to try and correlate with the urologist if a patient has a rising a lab test called a PSA, is there a hidden cancer in the prostate gland? We do MRIs for breast MRI. It's very good. Secondary examination after a mammogram to try and find a small breast cancer in a woman who may have very dense breasts. So the parameters, how MRI has really exploded through the rest of the medical field has been wonderful. They're finding new and different ways to analyze different parts of the body with an MRI. But so that's what it is. So it depends on what you go in for, but really an MRI can look at most things. The only place an MRI falters a little bit is, you know, if people are moving around in the magnet, they are susceptible to motion artifact, and it can be hard because the MRI is a tight space. But they're trying to overcome that with larger open bore magnets and open MRI for people who are more claustrophobic. So MRI has certainly come a long way since its inception in the mid 1980s.
Why? Maybe you can answer that. Why is it when someone is undergoing an MRI, that constant banging, bang, 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 you know, which is very noisy. What's going on while that happens?
That's a great question, Doug. I don't know the answer. I'm not an MR manufacturer. I know they've tried to reduce the noise for that. I've had my own issues with the spine, so I've been in plenty of MRIs. I have. I'm not, you know what I mean? I've been in the magnet, and it is quite noisy and loud, but it's just the way the machine is trying to generate and direct high-strength magnetic fields towards a certain spot.
And another question, when you're looking at the results of an MRI, you know, an X-ray is all black and white. Are you looking at it in, have they developed color with MRI, or is it black and white again?
No, it's certainly, yes, it certainly can be color. The varying shades of gray on an X-ray is black and white and shades of gray. MRI,
right.
I'm not saying it's blue, purples, and yellows, but it's all reliant on how much water is in a particular substance. So if someone had, let's just pretend they had sinusitis, or they have a cold, like I have a cold right now. Their sinuses mm-hmm. have a lot of water in them, so they'd be very, very bright. Where water molecules locked into our bone, which is very dense, don't really spin. So they show up as black on an MRI because they never generated a signal because they never could spin because they're locked in a bony matrix. Versus my sinusitis, the molecules of inflammation are just spinning around freely. So it's very white, then very black. But also there's you know, muscles can be pinkish. There are definitely hues of the spectrum of the prism on an MRI. Not too much green, but you can definitely see more color contrast on an MRI than a typical X-ray.
Interesting. Something else. Let me ask you, how long does it take you to analyze or read a typical MRI image? It depends on what you're looking for, I guess. Would that be right?
Yeah, they're so varied. I also read cardiac MRIs. We'll do like 25 different sequences of the heart cycle, and it may be,
right.
I don't know, it may be 3,000 images versus if we had somebody who had a concussion and as a 12-year-old girl in a soccer game who was otherwise completely normal and had a concussion and was having headaches and her MRI of the brain was done and she's 100% normal, no bleed, that is a different animal altogether. You know, you can read that and look at everything maybe and dictate a report in under maybe 10 minutes or 12 minutes, where a cardiac MR may certainly take at least an hour or if not longer.
That's amazing. All right, there are many other technologies that you work with. Explain these for us. Let's go through the list. What about radiography? What is that? That's a typical X-ray, I guess. Is that the name for it?
That is correct. That is correct. That's using, you know, and X-ray photons were the first imaging test ever invented by William Röntgen way back in the late 1800s. And it uses a low radioactivity particle that is shot from an X-ray machine and goes through the body and lands on a film behind the patient, and how much the film absorbs or the patient absorbs will give you the varying shades of black, gray, white, things like that. So it does use a very small amount of radiation, and a CAT scan machine works very similar to an X-ray machine. It really does. It uses X-ray photon machines spinning around the patient with a CAT scan X-ray film on the opposite side, and because you're doing it three-dimensionally, you can get much greater levels of contrast density than just a typical X-ray. You can. And the computer software is very, very robust for CAT scans nowadays, even compared back to the mid-70s when they first came out. But the basic technology for a CT scan and X-ray is the same. It's low-dose radiation penetrating a patient and landing on a film receptor on the other side of the patient, which then gets processed and viewed by a radiologist.
So then a CAT scan, in effect, would really be a more sophisticated X-ray. Would that be pretty accurate?
Yes, but that is accurate, and it's quite more sophisticated.
Yeah, yeah. Ultrasound, we hear about that a lot. Explain that to me.
Ultrasound is a separate imaging study that does not use any radiation, and it makes sense because we certainly ultrasound fetuses and pregnant women all the time. It uses high-frequency ultrasound beams that will perfectly penetrate the body, and how it rebounds off the tissues, what projects the ultrasound waves, and is the receiver is in the sonographer's hand. And then the different tissues of either has gas or fluid like a gallbladder or a solid organ like a liver or a baby with amniotic fluid around it, all generate different colored signals, and you can actually, you can actually see, and it's the great thing about ultrasound is it's right in your hand, and you can it's dynamic. It's not where a patient's laying on a CAT scan table, and that is an image in time. Once the scan's over, they're off the table. Ultrasound is I can go in and scan, and we can, if there's a baby, we can roll the baby over, and we do musculoskeletal ultrasound where I'm trying to figure out if a baby has dislocated hips, a newborn, and so I can grab their hips and push on them and twist them as I'm scanning the baby at the same time. So it's a much more robust, dynamic exam with no radiation. So it's great. You can scan all day long, and there's really no damage to the tissues, and you can really get a great look of structures without any permanent damage to the tissues.
Well, I lost contact here with you a minute, Doctor. Hold on here. Something happened. Stay right there. Don't go away. Are you there?
Okay.
Hello. Okay.
I am here. Yes, sir.
Okay. I also wanted to ask you about nuclear medicine scans. Is that the proper term for it?
Yes, it is. Yes. Nuclear medicine scans basically work on the premise of, depending on what they're looking for, people may have had a bone scan. That's a typical nuclear medicine scan. What they'll do is they'll take a small amount of your blood out and link up minimally radioactive isotope to components of your blood and then re-inject it back into your body. And part of that blood will go preferentially to your bone. And as it settles in your bone, you come back like 7 or 8 hours later, and then they'll scan you under the camera. And areas that are more hypermetabolic, even normally, like a kid's growth plates, will be more intense on the nuclear medicine camera. If patients have, unfortunately, metastatic disease of their cancer that has spread to the bones, that's more metabolically active. And so that'll show up as very bright, very intense on the nuclear medicine scan. And lately, in the last 10 to 15 years, we use things called a PET scan, which is called positron emission tomography, which basically injects glucose, which most cancers take up very, very actively. It's a sugar that we all use. And it's a great way to analyze how is their cancer treatment working. Is it knocking off the cancer in their body? Their PET scan from 2 years ago was positive, but now they've been undergoing chemotherapy for a year, and then they get a follow-up PET scan to see what's the result. And hopefully, the hypermetabolic cancer has either completely gone away or dramatically decreased. But PET scans are very, very, very helpful, especially if someone who has many people in Pennsylvania and Ohio and out in Arizona have pulmonary nodules in their lungs because of things we breathe in the air here that are very common. So when you see pulmonary nodules, you don't know if it's cancer or not. If it's just one big pulmonary nodule, then you really don't know. Well, before you have to get a needle in your chest and have to have a biopsy. Well, now PET scan, you put it into a PET scan, and if it takes up a lot of the sugar, then it's suspicious. Then, but if it doesn't take up any of the sugar, it's probably a benign nodule, and you can leave it alone. So we really avoid a lot of biopsies and things like that by using PET scans today, which are very, very helpful.
You know, this is all such sophisticated technology. I guess a simple question would be, how does one determine which test is the best for a specific patient? And I guess, obviously, the answer is depends on what is wrong with the patient. But how would you answer that question?
It's a great question. Most of the radiology exams, I would say well over 75%, are very, very standard. And most of the physicians, especially general surgeons and orthopedic surgeons, know exactly what they want. And especially for a patient who has generalized abdominal pain or they've had trauma or a bowel obstruction, then a CAT scan of the abdomen and pelvis is certainly warranted. An obstetrician certainly knows their way around a fetal ultrasound and things like that. But there are weird examinations that, you know, a family practitioner may scratch their head and say, geez, I don't think a CAT scan's right. Can I do an MRI of this? Can I do that? The best thing they should do is call the radiologist. And we get calls every day, and I'm very grateful for the call because I'd rather get a call from a PA or a family practitioner or internal medicine doctor who has a legitimate question. It's a weird presentation. It's a weird exam, and they don't quite know. Like, they're not sure if a CAT scan is going to do it or what kind of CAT scan should they order. We can give IV contrast. We can give oral contrast. We can do all kinds of things to help the examination out. But the best thing for them to do is call radiologists. And at our hospital, it's very easy because we're centrally located. We have a large group. We're 28 radiologists, and so it's easy to get a hold of us. They electronically communicate with us. It's very, very easy to reach out to us. And they can even do it through the electronic medical record. They can send us a communication chat box and say, hey, can you give me a call? I have a question about patient A and about something BCD. So it really, it's the best thing to do is, just like I would ask a general surgeon, what's the best procedure for this and that, they should ask the radiologist.
You know, I was just going to ask you, do you ever, and you answered it partially there, I guess, but generally, does the radiologist actually confer with the physician who's treating the patient, or is that a rarity?
Not routinely, but no, if there's a surprise finding, I certainly do. We're a very busy ER, so we may have someone who just like almost like slipped and fell down one step or two steps. Not a huge trauma, a small trauma, but they're also elderly and they're taking blood thinners for a heart condition. Well, now they have a bigger intracranial hemorrhage than anybody ever expected, right? So I immediately call the ER physician or the neurosurgeon who's on call. To say, hey, listen, this patient this patient needs surgery to have this blood clot taken out or whatever to alert them. Or if it's someone with vague abdominal pain and it's unfortunately cancer. You know, it's something more of a surprise than just an appendicitis or a kidney stone. It's something ominous. Well, I call the doctor. I call the doctor right away. Say, listen, this is what this patient has. Versus them finding out from some report that gets generated, an hour later. I'd rather call them. So certainly a lot of us are talking to physicians day in and day out. Sometimes, especially if I'm on the ER all day long, I'll be making 20 phone calls at least during the day.
And by the way, do you ever actually work in direct contact with the patient? Do you have any patient care that you do as a radiologist?
Me personally, some radiologists may not, but I do. I do a lot of ultrasound. So I do a fair amount of ultrasound-guided biopsies that we can biopsy thyroid glands and nodes and livers and things like that. And also, fluoroscopy is almost like moving x-rays. If you ever saw there's always pictures on TV or commercials where you see somebody swallowing a Snickers bar or something like that. And when you see them, the x-rays are moving. That's fluoroscopy. Well, that involves giving the patient some a liquid to drink called barium, which shows up very well on an x-ray, and working with the patient, hey, rolling them around, Doug, spinning them, getting the barium to roll one direction or another direction. So we will certainly work with RPAs and direct patient care. And I also do a lot of joint injections, and I do a fair amount of spinal taps and lumbar punctures, which are the same thing. So in that way, yes, I'm not a primary care physician, but I'm a sort of the tertiary referral. If a doctor thinks someone has meningitis or whatever, they need a spinal tap, I'll be the one to be doing it.
Interesting indeed. By the way, I ought to point out, we're talking with Dr. Joseph Burke. He's based in Wyomissing, Pennsylvania, but he's with a firm known as Radiologic Medical Legal Services. And as you said, you're a big firm with a lot of radiologists involved. And you're getting the results of MRIs and things like that from hospitals throughout your area, would that be right, not just one specific hospital?
Well, our hospital, there are certainly some groups who have contracts with multiple hospitals, Doug, but our hospital is it's about 750 beds, and that's just a number. That's a pretty sizable hospital. So we really just service-ready hospital. It's certainly large enough for our 28-person group, and that's just all the inpatients. But you can imagine the network of outpatient doctors and patients who have mammograms and x-rays and slip and fell and went to one of our local urgent care centers. Well, those x-rays all get funneled into us. And certainly we will see a lot of, you know, MRI magnets that we have. We have 7 or 8 outpatient imaging centers associated with the hospital that, you know, you don't need to be in a hospital to get your MRI of your knee. So you'll go to one of the outpatient imaging centers, and they all those imaging studies get referred to us all during the day. And so, yeah, we're busy enough to have 15, 16 doctors working full-time all day long. And then we staff right up till almost midnight. We'll have 3 physicians working every night till midnight.
And is it typical the doctors are actually waiting for the results of an MRI before they need this information as soon as possible before they actually determine how they're going to treat the patient?
I think typically what they'll do is if it's super what's called a stat exam, like if you went to your family doctor's, you just went to a family doctor, you had some flank pain or belly pain, and he or they think you have a kidney stone, they would send you for a CAT scan and you get the results right away, and then they would say, hey, well, geez, you do have a blockage, you need to go to the ER. But oftentimes it's, you know, you tweaked your knee playing pickleball, you went to see your doctor, they wait, you know, they give you some conservative therapy, 6 weeks later it's still really bothering you. Then they'll send you for an MRI, and typically we will read the MRI before your next appointment to the orthopedic surgeon, right? So he or she will have the results of the MRI. You've torn a meniscus. Okay, we've tried rest and rehab. It hasn't worked. Now you need XYZ. And so that's a typical pathway for that.
You know, there's one other thing about your practice. I want to point out you've become an expert witness in many medical cases that have gone to that are being tried. What kind of situation would that be? Somebody's suing the hospital or they're suing a doctor where your testimony would be critical?
Correct, Doug. I think I've heard from other podcasts of yours that you're well familiar with tort reform and the changes it's made, good and bad, for the medical community. And one of the downsides of tort reform, which I think is valuable, one of the downsides is now most lawsuits involve suing almost everyone they can get their hands on.
Exactly.
And I was personally sued about 15 years ago for an MRI of the cerebral circulation called an MRA, which I read correctly, and I communicated correctly to the doctor's offices. And it was all documented and things like that. And eventually I was dropped from the case. But that took 3 years to drop me from the case. And so the attorney I was working with was actually – I'm just a very proactive and I guess my family called me anal person to say I was always making sure the reports were accurate. And whatever my team needed, the defense team, I would have it instantly for them the next day. And the attorney I worked with way back then said, you should think about doing this because – you're really quite good at explaining things. You're very organized, efficient, and proactive. You really enjoyed doing some of this. And my kids were very, very young back then, and I was just kind of – it was really busy time. So I circled back 5 years later after that lawsuit and asked him if he could help me get started. And he was a generous, wonderful man, and he did. He said, hey, you should do this. And so I've been doing medical malpractice, mostly radiology work, for about the last 8 or 9 years.
Well, doctor, listen, you're coming back again next week. We're out of time for today. Pardon me, but we're going to explore that aspect of your practice and your talents next week because you're returning to Close Up Talk Radio, and we're excited to have you back again. We've been talking to Dr. Joseph Burke. Again, he's based in Wyomissing, Pennsylvania, and as you have heard, he is highly knowledgeable in his field of medical care. So it's been exciting, Doctor. Thanks for taking the time. We look forward to next week when you return, okay?
Doug, thanks for having me, and have a great, great holiday.
Thank you very much, Dr. Burke. Happy New Year to you, too.
Thank you.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television, Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.
Well, that's it for today, everybody. I'm Doug Llewellyn. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next time. Till then, Happy New Year.